So, Bob, it's that time of year where I'm trying to clean out all of my emails, trying to answer everyone's emails so we can start the new year anew. I'm trying to find my two-minute timer. I'm actually going to use the two-minute timer for lightning round, but for me.
Uh-huh.
You don't need a restraint because you're not as narcissistic as I am. So I'm going to have this two-minute timer, and we're going to lightning round this
oh,
shit.
Oh, famous last words.
What
I
do
love
you say?
It. Yep.
This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Hanna. I'm a therapist and a professor.
And I am your friend, Bob, from graduate school and a therapist in practice here in Seattle.
Annual patron Natasha from California, good old patron Natasha. She says, "Hey, Kirk and Bob, I've had four sessions with my current therapist, and I think I like her, but I'm not quite sure about her approach, which is narrative therapy. I was trying to get into my personality issues and the way I sometimes treat people, and she had this way of turning everything I said into a positive, and it kind of frustrated me. I was telling her about this time I'd wronged a coworker, and nothing about what I did was nice, but she narrativized it as me persevering. She narrativized it as, you know, so Natasha's like, yeah, I wronged this coworker. I wasn't very nice to this person. But she narrativized it as me persevering and going for what I want. And I don't know if that's a helpful approach for me. I get wanting to build my self-esteem, but I feel like this is the most I've ever been able to get out of a therapist, being told that I'm actually great, even when I do things that fuck people over and hurt their feelings. I don't know if she has any other mode, though. If I bring it up, will she just keep doing it? Should I even be bothered by it? Bob, what do you think?
Well, you definitely should talk about it. Yeah. I mean, imagine not talking about it.
But Natasha has a viable worry that the therapist might actually not have a different mode. Like, this might be this therapist's only mode is to be positive, so to speak.
It sounds like the fear is that she's going to put lipstick on a pig, like, and be disingenuous.
Yeah.
Like, and say, you know, up is down and, you know, basically whitewash or distort things to such a point for, you know, whatever reason. I don't know what reason it would be, but that's the fear, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't think that's a good idea in general.
Meaning you don't think it's a good idea. What don't you think is a good idea?
I don't think we should invalidate the, I don't think we should validate the invalid. Like, if I do hurt somebody, all right, there's a reason for everything that everybody does. You could always find a reason in a context, and that's not hard to do. But denying the consequences of a thing is just silly.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I might have a very good reason for, you know, let's say I yell at Colleen or something. Mm-hmm. They might have a context that's not a very good reason, but an understandable context from which that comes. Yeah, mm-hmm. that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also unwholesome or destructive or against my morals or whatever. Mm-hmm. And
right. So to paint everything that one does in a positive light is to put lipstick on a pig.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what Natasha's describing. I think regardless, if you don't talk about it with your therapist, then this thing's going to run around in the back of your head. It's going to distract you.
Yeah. Give it a try. Talk with your therapist. It's possible that your therapist has just one mode, but I'm guessing that, particularly because you say in the beginning that you think you like her, and, you know, there's a human in there that isn't just the mode. So I would suspect that they would be able to adjust, or at least give them a chance, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Or maybe your therapist can convince you as to why the approach is the way that it is. Narrative therapy, to a lesser extent than, say, solution-focused therapy, these modes of therapy can be very odd to the, especially if you have an expectation going into therapy, especially if you want to talk about problems the way that a lot of people do in therapy. These modes have a very rigid way of looking at therapy and what's helpful, and I like those approaches. I will dip into them sometimes, but I'm not sold on the premise that they will often say that it's helpful in all situations.
Oh, you know? Yeah, right.
You ask a narrative therapist, solution-focused therapist, brief therapist, if sometimes a different approach might be helpful. And in my experience, at least half, especially if they're a trainer, will say something like, yeah, this works in basically all situations. And evidence has shown, da 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 da, and they can make a case for it. And this is what I, when I teach solution focus and narrative therapy, positive, brief, collaborative therapies to people, this is the very thing that I will tell people as a caution, is that when you utilize these forms and a client wants to talk, usually people want to talk about problems with other people. You know, my spouse or my mom is doing this to me and I don't like it. And these approaches tend to not be validating, or they want to steer away from quote unquote the problem. And they want to focus on strengths. They want to focus on solutions. They don't want to, in their mind, be bogged down on the uselessness of discussing negativity. And so they will often have very effective ways, but of routing it in that direction. But it runs the risk of alienating the client and invalidating the client. You know, the client, Natasha, is saying, I wronged a coworker.
Right.
I was wrong. I did something that was hostile to this person or something.
Right.
And it wasn't fair.
You right.
know, I was triggered. And you and I can, that's our world, you
right.
know, schemas and reactivity right. and traumas being triggered and misunderstandings and differentiation, emotional reactivity.
Right.
It's all the place that we live. And we could live that in that place forever and never even have the urge to quote unquote steer away from it and find a lot of therapeutic value, positive outcomes in therapy. But if the therapist is oriented a different way and they only have that one mode, then yeah, it can feel bad. It just comes down to truth in advertising and screening people, right? If you're this sort of therapist, you should really do extra work to make sure people understand what they're getting into. And I've known solution-focused therapists and other brief therapists who are very good at this. They'll say, before they even talk with the client, they'll just be like, so I just want to tell you, I'm not like your typical therapist, and here's my approach. And so I just want to ask you if this is okay with you.
Right.
But we could also imagine some therapists being ineffective, or they don't know they're supposed to do that.
Right.
And people come to them thinking that they're going to get a particular brand. And really, this is true for any therapy,
yes.
even if you're more kind of humanistic, mainstreamy like you and I are, I think, to explain it to people. But
yeah.
It's hard because you don't have a lot of time in that period of time to explain, one. Two, therapists aren't really trained at being able to explain what they do. Three, clients might not have any idea what you're talking about,
right.
even if you did effectively explain what you do. They're
right.
just like, huh, you know, it's hard. And sometimes you just have to muddle through it and see if the approach works
right.
for you. But yeah, so I'd bring it up, Natasha, and just say something like, so I noticed that when I bring up something that is a problem with me, you will, you know, spin it in a positive way, which I appreciate because, you know, self-esteem is important. But to me, what I'm looking for is blank, whatever that is, Natasha.
Right.
If I were talking, this is Kirk, then I would say what I'm looking for is not to necessarily build up my self-esteem, but actually to explore why it is that I do these things repetitively, why I interpret things in a way that causes me to be unfair to other people. And because I don't want to be unfair to other people, I want to be fair, and I want to not worry about it afterwards, and I want to have good relationships. I want people to trust me. I want people to like me, you know, in the same way that I don't want to be treated unfairly. I don't want to treat other people unfairly. So that's the goal that I'm looking for in therapy, you know. Now, there's a chance, Natasha, that even though the approach that you don't like it is actually going to help you. There are examples that I've worked with where that's true, where people will resist the brief therapy mode. You know, they'll get frustrated with it. How come we're not talking about this, this, and this? I want to talk about this, this, and this. And then the therapist sticks with their mode. You fast forward 3 months, 6 months, and the client's like, you know, remember when I was really resistant to this mode and I thought it wasn't going to work? Well, I was wrong. It really is working on me.
Right.
It's an indirect way of actually getting to the outcome I want anyway. Natasha also asks, why is it so effing hard to find a relationally oriented therapist? I know you've compared finding a therapist to dating, but at this point, I feel like dating is easier. I've cycled through about 15 therapists since 2016, and none of them do therapy the way the two of you do. It's just me, you know, you and me, Bob.
Yeah.
I thought my new one seemed promising, but I was getting into my self-concept in relation to change in my life. She started going into all the ways I could be proactive and talking a lot. And I kind of shut down because I just want someone to talk to me the way the two of you talk to each other. Where are the good clinicians hiding? Bob, what do you think?
Well, I don't know. I mean, are we idealized, do you think?
Perhaps. But I think it is a valid question.
Yeah, it is. You're right.
That yep. If we thought about different pockets that are, I think, more prevalent in our field, brief therapies, cognitive behavioral therapies, people who might think they're being relational oriented, but they haven't received the training or the amount of, because, you know, I think you even said in the beginning of your career,
oh yeah,
you were different.
Yes, much.
So even though you have the capacity and you're a smart person, you're very dedicated, that for the first number of years, you would be one of those therapists that you as a client might say something like, will you stop what was the approach that, how would you describe it?
Back then?
Yeah. Pragmatic or something?
More like sort of quasi-object relations. Uh-huh. And then there was a DBT period, uh-huh, where it was, you know, CBT or DBT or whatever. And
those are all good things.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
You might ignore or pass over opportunities in therapy that are more, how would you describe it?
That we're focusing on what's the experience that we're having here together right now, which I think is really valuable. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, but let's be real, that might not be the best approach for all people either. Mm-hmm. It's just the only one I know well.
Well, I find that all clients, all people can benefit from it, regardless of what they're coming in for. Mm-hmm. Might there be other approaches in addition, if they're trying to quit smoking, for example,
yeah, that's right,
a different thing, or if they're working on their relationships at home and they're trying to think about how to be more differentiated, how to engineer that, or, you know, that kind of thing.
But anyway, simple trauma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or even complex trauma, recovery, mm-hmm, is a specific mode,
right,
of exposure. But what I would say is that it is hard. I would maybe look for keywords like relationally oriented therapist or interpersonal therapist or intersubjective, mm-hmm, therapist. There's also relational psychoanalysis, which isn't huge, but those people out there, relational psychoanalytic or, you know, psychoanalysts. I would also look for humanistic phraseology, experiential, here and now kind of words. I would also interview the therapist, yeah, before talking to this. Like, yeah. So I'm looking for someone that's relationally oriented. Do you know what that means? And can you prove to me that you understand it?
Right.
Because anyone can say they're that, and they might not be that.
Sure, right.
So over the phone, it wouldn't be hard for you and I. So someone asks you that, someone calls you up, Bob. So I'm looking for a relational-oriented therapist, or I'm looking for a here-and-now therapist, or I'm looking for a humanistic therapist who will really go deep with me in terms of how I relate to other people and who I am as a person. How would you respond to that on the phone?
You mean if they ask me if that's what I do?
Yeah.
I would say I don't pay a whole lot of attention to content. So if you come in and you're talking about, you know, the fact that, you know, your boss didn't give you a raise that you deserved, I probably wouldn't be interested in figuring out what you're going to do about that or how you want to be about that. I'd be interested in what's happening between us right now that makes this important to you right now. Something's up. You're wanting something from me specific. Can we be explicit about what that is? Because most of the time people want something, but they actually don't know what it is. They haven't articulated it for themselves. It's sort of implicit. Mm-hmm. And I always think, you know me, I always think about the Wizard of Oz. It's the wizard behind the curtain. It says, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain, but that's the wizard. And, yeah, and everybody has that in them. So I'd be interested in, as you bring this up, not shutting you down, not saying, oh, we're not going to talk about that and give you a hard time about it, but like, hey, can we be clear about what it is that you want from me? Mm-hmm. What you're hoping for? Maybe what you're wanting is some validation. Okay, right, that's a reasonable thing. Or maybe, mm-hmm, you're wanting somebody to commiserate with or whatever, but what being plain about what you want, I think that's really useful. I think that's important, and I think we don't pay enough attention to that in, mm-hmm, general.
Yeah. Yeah, good. The way that I would say it off the top of my head, it's been a while since I've even had a new client.
Elevator speech.
Huh?
Elevator speech.
Yeah. Is, I would say, well, the belief system that I have, and it's stood up to you know, scrutiny over time in my 25 years is that when, you always want to sneak in some expertise, little bits there,
right,
you
know,
is that I, when I work with people, and really when I'm talking with anyone in my life, when they are telling me a difficult story, whether it's problems with their boss at work or a loss they've had or conflict with their partner or, I don't know, just self-esteem issues, I find that if we can really just sit with your experience of what you're going through, whether that's joy or sadness or anger or whatever, if we can really just sit and you can fully explore your emotion, your experience, and I don't get in your way, but I am there with you and I am valuing your experience and your feelings. We might even talk about how you feel about things right now, about me, or what's happening in your body right now. Mm-hmm. I find that when we really explore that, that people have positive outcomes, not only just feeling better, knowing themselves better, but also better able to navigate relationships and not get triggered to do things that are that contribute to conflict and strife in relationships, because that's usually where it comes from, is one, lack of awareness of who we are, because it's not often we get a chance to really explore that in our modern lives. And two, we have a lot of hurts. We have a lot of relational hurts from our past that will wounds that will get poked at and have never really healed. And if we can heal those wounds relationally, then we're less likely to react. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I like it. Yeah. Good speech.
Yeah. So I would just interview people along those lines and see if that works, Natasha. Let's take a break. When we get back, let's actually do lightning round. What do you say, Bob? So, Bob, on Patreon, when we published the Bob interview episode, someone commented, patron Christine, and she said, great episode. Where was Bob going when he hit the student driver?
Oh, God, I never talk about this.
Where were you going?
I just never talk about it. I don't even know if I've ever told you.
Oh, what do you mean? Where you were going is a secret?
Or even this part of my life, yeah.
Oh, do you not want to talk about it?
No, I don't want to talk about it at all, but at this point in life, it's just silly.
I mean, you don't have to.
No, I know I don't have to, but fuck it.
Wow, this patron Christine really struck gold at this question.
When I moved, patron Christine. Yeah, I read that comment there, Christine, and, you know, thought about it. I'm like, I don't know. Am I going to talk about that? Anyways, here's the deal.
Oh.
I moved here in 1992 from Pennsylvania. And when I was in Pennsylvania, I worked at this psychiatric hospital. And part of it was that they had 5 units, really lovely place. Not what you think of at all when you think psych hospital. This beautiful, it doesn't matter. And I worked on the children's unit, but occasionally they'd be short-staffed on one of the other units, and I would float over there, and I would, you know, spend the shift there. I was a tech, mental health tech. I think they call them a psych tech now or something like that. Anyways, one of the units was a chemical dependency unit and for teens. And I found those young people to be just fascinating, like sophisticated in a way that I hadn't noticed other teens similar age being, and kind of wisdom in them. They were really impressive to me.
By the way, it is odd. I can't visualize you working with kids and teens, because in our career,
I know,
since I've known you, you've never worked with kids or teens.
No, I never have.
So that's a weird visual for me.
Yeah, right. Well, I don't think I'm particularly good at it. So they would have...
I can see you being really good with teens.
Maybe now, but I think back then I was... probably that wouldn't have been the best fit for me. Or I would have needed a lot more training. Anyways, oh shit, where was I going?
Where were you going?
They would have 12-step meetings on the unit. And so we would go to them, right? And we wouldn't participate, we'd just be observing. And the kids would run them themselves or whatever. And then I had a friend that I work with at the runaway shelter. I had two jobs, actually many jobs, but I had those two jobs concurrent. And she was a member of Overeaters Anonymous, you know? And occasionally I'd go to meetings with her, not because I actually have a problem with food, but because I loved her and she was my good friend, and they were open meetings, and she said, yeah, come with me. And so I did, and it's cool, right? Really cool. So when I moved here, I was lonely. I lived with my brother, but I was really lonely, and I decided I would just start going to AA. So I went to AA for a year. And
Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yeah, yeah. And I didn't drink during that year. And at one point, I was running a meeting in... Did I ever tell you this? I was running a meeting in Bellevue every Tuesday at the Grace Lutheran Church there on 108th. They gave me a key to the church. I'd go there early, unlock the place, set up the coffee, blah, blah, blah. Pass out who's going to read the...
So you went to AA to not drink? Or yeah. Is that just a like just a byproduct?
I went to AA because I had a question about my drinking. And
oh, you did? You actually legit wanted to know if you had a problem with your drinking?
Yeah. Well, I thought I might because there were some things that I did that were, you know, alcohol abusive. Uh-huh. So...
Meaning that you would drink to drown your sorrows or...
Just drink too much.
Drink too much.
So I had a concern about it. And
you were 25 at the time or something?
I was 25. Yeah. Yeah, when I moved here, I was 25. And I was also here in this city where I didn't know anybody. Mm-hmm. And even though I was living with my brother, he was gone a lot because he's, you know, Coast Guard said he'd go underway. So I'd be on my own a lot. So I just started going to AA meetings. And
so did you feel like kind of like a fraud? Like you weren't?
No.
Or did you legit say, I have a problem with alcohol?
Yeah. I used to say, hi, my name's Bob. I'm an alcoholic.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the way you were building it up, it sounded like you were saying you were doing it to meet friends or something.
I was.
But you were also doing it legit.
Legit. To... Like I was really, you know, I actually stopped drinking. I didn't drink for a year. I did 90
meetings. And the fact that you pointed out going to Overeaters Anonymous meant that it sort of opened your eyes to the idea that maybe you have a problem?
Yes.
I see. And then working in the addictions unit with the teens also opened your eyes to maybe have a problem.
I don't know about that, but I just remember being impressed with those young people. Okay. And their...
So those are kind of precursors that introduced you to the world of 12-step and the ideas of alcohol abuse. And then when you come to Seattle, you don't want to drink and you want to meet people.
Yeah.
So you started going to this group and you got really into it and you were now the leader and that sort of thing.
Okay. I did 90 meetings in 90 days and eventually ended up running this meeting on Tuesdays at Grace Lutheran Church in Bellevue. And I did that for a year.
Did you make friends?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then at some point, I think I started questioning whether or not it was true. I was working for a woman over on Mercer Island.
So if I met you during that time, you never would have... Because, you know, the first time we hung out socially was you invited me to have a beer.
Yeah.
At the Sit and Spin, right?
Yeah.
And if I had met you during this time, you would not have asked me to do that. And if I had asked you to have a beer at the Sit and Spin, you would have said, I don't drink.
Yeah, I would have gone and had a soda or something.
Okay.
Because it wasn't like I was, you know, not willing to go to a bar or whatever. Shit, my brother said to me, oh, fine, we have a designated driver.
Interesting.
So I was working for this lady over on Mercer Island that I met because my sponsor lived in her house. She had a clean and sober house, and I did like yard work for her for many, many, many months, my first bit of time here. And I had two sponsors in AA. And toward the end of that year, my friend Martin said to me, Bob, what are you doing here? You're not an alcoholic.
Really?
Yeah. And he was right. I'm not an alcoholic. I mean, you've known me, you know, more than half my life. You know that I'm not.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't frame you that way at all, but you would imagine that someone in that world would have a pretty broad definition of who would benefit from not drinking. You know what I mean?
I don't know that what he said to me was a good thing. I just know it was true. I'm not an alcoholic.
In the sense that you weren't like the other members in that your life hadn't completely fallen apart.
Not even close. Yeah, Martin.
And there wasn't seemingly any kind of risk of that. And so he detected it, I'm guessing, correct me if I'm wrong, because they all had years of really horrible stories and life falling apart and a lot of hitting bottom, if you will.
Right.
And you had none of those stories.
You were just a
guy in your 20s who maybe... like a typical young 20s person, drank too much on a few different nights, but you still woke up the next day and went to work and things weren't falling apart and you weren't drinking to mask trauma.
Like that, no, and I wasn't drinking out of control in such a way that I'd like, you know, the really severe stuff that people say, it's not really how it is for many, many alcoholics, but nonetheless, I certainly didn't have those kind of stories.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, having said that, I would imagine that on a certain even conservative threshold scale that you did qualify for the diagnosis and could have benefited from not drinking. I mean, a lot of people can benefit from not drinking, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Who wouldn't be classified as a sort of classic alcoholic, you know?
What did you remember who our addictions teacher was?
Lisa Erickson,
yeah.
She was on this podcast. We still rerun her episode where she talks about gifted kids.
Oh, I really liked her.
Yeah.
Anyways, I never forget what she said in class. She's like, well, not all use is abuse and not all abuse is addiction. And I'd say I was abusing alcohol at times back then. And so I went to AA and to fill, I was really scared about being here on my own. So,
yeah. And that guy, Martin, was he telling you not to come?
No.
What he was never he saying would have said that, for? That?
He was just like, what are you doing here? Yeah. You're not.
So what'd you do?
Well, I was already thinking about it. I wasn't going to meetings nearly the frequency that I was back then. I stopped working for the clean and sober house lady, really lovely person. She was in her 80s when I met her. We used to sit and have lunch in her living room and talk. She was really cool. I liked her. But what they say, one of the things they say in AA is a head full of AA and a belly full of beer is a bad combination. And so,
what does that mean?
It means that if you're already thinking that you have a problem with alcohol when you drink, it gives you pause.
Meaning that it will make whatever sort of good things can come from drinking alcohol go away because you know better? Is that?
It's sort of like, I know what I'm doing. I know what I'm doing is potentially, if I'm an alcoholic, it's definitely risky. But I find myself doing it anyways. It's sort of like in my head, there's a part of me that knows you shouldn't do this, like danger, Will Robinson. And then there's another part that's like, well, I just want this alcohol.
Yeah.
So.
And the idea is you shouldn't be drinking.
Yeah. Well, right. Yeah. Because of shitty consequences or whatever. So I was home. It was a Saturday and this is before grad school. And so before I met you, I knew I wasn't an alcoholic and I'd stopped going to the meetings, but it's not like that just leaves you. So I opened a beer and I sat there for 2 hours looking at it, feeling really weird.
Hmm.
And I was by myself and I watched the last episode of MASH. It was like a rerun. This is in 93. Sat and looked, I stared at, I hadn't gone to AA in probably 4 or 5 months, but I still hadn't drank. Anyways, then I had a beer and it was fine, right?
So how do you feel about it now?
I feel okay about it now, but I've never talked about this. I'm calling knows about it, but I'm embarrassed to talk about it.
I mean, you've talked about a lot of things with me and on this podcast.
Yeah.
Why is this story set like even lower on the list of things that you things would that care to about. Share?
When we were in school, there was another program there called Whole Systems Design. You remember that?
Yeah.
And one of my sponsors was a student.
Oh.
A guy called Rob. Nice man.
He was in that program?
Yeah. And I didn't know he was. We were in grad school, I think maybe 4 or 5 months. We were just standing in front of the building after class one night, and I saw him walk into the building. And I was just absolutely embarrassed because it's not like I said goodbye to him. I just dropped out.
You didn't say goodbye to everybody.
I didn't say goodbye to any. I said goodbye to Martin.
You didn't say, and you were pretty ingrained in this community.
Well, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
We ran that meeting. And
you ran the meeting.
Yeah.
And how many people were typical in that meeting?
30 or 40.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you just did the show.
I gave my key back and yeah.
People notice that. Even if you're not the leader, they will sometimes notice like, oh, I guess we're not seeing Bob.
Yeah.
And the assumption is that you've fallen off the wagon and things are bad.
It's an anonymous program. It's not like people are going
to.
And
even if
you.
Martin knew the story, he couldn't say anything.
We didn't,
So it's just like, I wonder what happened to Bob.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And so then you saw one of those.
I saw Rob, people, my sponsor.
And you thought what?
I don't know if he saw me, but I know I was scared that I'd run into him and he'd ask me, where have you been?
And what were you scared of?
I'm like, oh, I'm drinking now and he's going to think that I'm, I don't know what, in denial or something.
Deluding yourself into thinking it's okay to not go to meetings and drink.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, and I kept those two worlds separate. Like my brother never met any of my AA friends. My AA friends never met my brother. I just kept them separate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that just feeds, shame or whatever. Mm. All Danny said to me when when I started drinking, it was, he said, oh, well, there goes our designated driver. So where I was going that morning was, I was late for an AA meeting on a Sunday morning. It was an 8 o'clock meeting, and I was rushing and I was late, and I blew a stop sign and I hit that poor man, scared the hell out of him.
So what's it like to tell me about, because you've never told me, what's it like to tell me?
It's been a couple of days since all that happened. So I think I'm sort of through the need to hide it, the sort of embarrassed need to hide it. It's just a part of my history. And a
couple of days because you saw the comment a few, not too long ago.
No, I mean, it's been years.
Oh.
I'm just sort of over it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So but I don't talk about this. Only some of our friends know about it. I think maybe Terry knows, but I don't even know if, I don't think the kids know. I don't think Michael and Beth know about that. I'm not sure. Well, they do now.
Well, if they listen. Yeah, I mean, I could, you know, I could totally see why you would be ashamed or reticent to talk about it, but I don't think it's shameful or worthy of being reticent.
No,
to me, it sounds like a totally viable period of your life where you thought, you know, you probably had some hangovers in your early 20s.
Oh, yeah.
And you're a burgeoning clinician, and you start to look at things and think, you know, I think, by definition, I do have a problem, and I need to work on this. And added benefit, I don't know anyone in Seattle. And
right, exactly.
So, and if I don't want to drink, then those are the people I want to hang out with. So, and then you're kind of a obsessive person to some extent.
Okay.
I mean, not as much as I am, but meaning that you get into something and you get into it.
Right.
And so you don't just sort of half-ass.
No, I didn't half-ass AA.
So you became the leader and you didn't have anything else to do. So 90 and 90.
Right.
You know, you probably didn't, or I know that you didn't lie or present a fraudulent fake self or something. You know, you were being honest and real and yourself. And then you progress to a point where, and you're thinking, well, maybe my life with moderation, it'd be okay.
It's okay.
And what I think is, well, correct me if I'm wrong, but if you could go back in time, would you have rather said goodbye to everyone and maybe even said, I think I'm sorry, but I'm thinking about trying moderation. Would you rather have said something?
I never thought about that. Yeah, I think that would have been better for me. I think I didn't. I just slunk away because I was ashamed. But I think it probably would have been better for me personally, whether people accept that or not. Though I don't think people are going to go around judging too much. But
I imagine a good number of them would have judged you as someone who was in denial.
In denial.
But whether they enacted some sort of active disdain of you or judgment of you is, you know, depending. But I would imagine a lot of people would be like, oh, we've heard this before. He'll be back or something.
I was very grateful to Martin for just being blunt with me about what he thought.
So do you think he was actually saying moderation is possible with someone like you?
Yeah.
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 And by the way, there's a whole topic of this, you know,
I know.
Of, you know, harm reduction and
can some people do moderation or do they really need to be abstinent?
And where's the threshold? And
right. Yeah, right. That's probably, yeah.
What's the denial and all this?
Yep. Yep.
And but for most people in that group with you, if they had even dabbled in moderation within a few months, 12 months at the latest, their life would be downward spiraling in this very obvious, horrible way, absolutely caused by the alcohol use in their life. You know, there's a real thing out there and a real usefulness to holding the line regarding complete abstinence and complete sobriety for some people. Harm reduction or moderation, I think, is possible for a lot of people. And we can get into the specifics on it, but there's a lot of dogmatic arguing in this zone. You know, like there'd be people that would hear you and say, like, well, let's count up all the consequences you've had because of your drinking.
Sure. Then you ask yourself, well, what makes it so important that somebody else decide whether or not I have a problem with alcohol?
Right. And also, there's a reason why people drink. They don't drink for the consequences, the negative ones. They drink for the positive ones, you know, the relaxation or the camaraderie or the I guess, the taste or the
right.
the culture yeah. or...
So the, we just did a promo about me liking champagne, for God's sake.
Yeah. Or the, you know, euphoria that yeah. you feel with, when, you, you know, there's a little bit of a intoxication.
My brother Danny never said anything to me about it one way or the other. He was really cool about it. But I think he was glad when I quit not drinking. I don't know how else to call it. Mm-hmm. We had about 6 months left together. I lived with them for 2 years. They were really important 2 years for me. And I thought when he left, I'd get depressed again. And I think when I started drinking again, I think that made it easier for him. And we used to hang out. You remember my house in West Seattle? Mm-hmm. He said to me, I didn't understand. He's like, Bob, this is probably the nicest place we're ever going to live. Not the house itself. The house was kind of falling apart. But the place we lived, we had this 180-degree view of the Sound. It was just unbelievable in West Seattle. And he's like, we're never going to live in a place this nice again. I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. But nope, that's true. Anyways, we used to sit out back on that deck and look at the Sound and watch the sun go down and drink scotch. He said to me, he was engaged to Gwen and they were going to get married that December. He left in May or June.
Did he meet her in Seattle?
No, he met her in high school.
Oh.
They had a long distance relationship most of their time together. And then he got restationed in New York and she moved up to New York for work. And they, you know, then they weren't long distance anymore. And,
Coast Guard.
Yeah. Yeah. He was in the Coast Guard in New York City, which is also kind of amazing because they put you on Governor's Island, which is like you look across the water and there's the Statue of Liberty and there's the Manhattan skyline, et cetera, et cetera. It's unbelievable. And yet you're in this like, it doesn't
matter. When you think of Coast Guard stations, you think of some dreary Pacific Northwest outpost where there's no population nearby and
A
lot of fishing boats and tanker ships and that kind of stuff.
And this was this old colonial, it doesn't matter. It's nice. It's nice there. Anyways, so we're sitting out back on the deck and we're watching the sun go down and we're just telling stories or whatever. And he said, actually, I'm not going to say what he said.
Okay.
Yeah. It was a good time. And I thought to myself at the time, I didn't waste these 2 years with him. Like we had a good 2 years together because I was really sad when he moved back and I was scared that I would fall back into depression. My brother is like an antidepressant for me and I didn't. It was okay, but they were an important 2 years for me, mostly because he taught me how to laugh.
So before that, you weren't a laughy guy?
Yeah, you know, I'm what I am, but I think I was prone to depression in my...
What was it about him that helped you?
He treats life like it's a game and he knows how to play it well. So he doesn't take things too seriously and he was adventurous. He's like, I want to learn how to fix my car. So he bought a bug and he taught himself how to fix his car. And me, I'm a good follower. So I bought a bug and I taught myself how to fix that car. He's like, I want to learn to play guitar. So he bought himself a guitar. And I'm like, okay, I'll learn how to play piano. So I bought a piano and he's like, someday we're going to own a bar and we're going to be the band. And I'm like, okay, I suck, but all right, fine. And he helped me see past my conventions.
Hmm.
So my brother's a good guy.
It's a huge gift.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was depressed back then. I was sort of wrestling with, you know, the fallout from childhood trauma, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. He, not by anything specific that he did or said, just by being in his presence and playing. We played a lot of pool. We went to a lot of bars and shot pool. We just shoot pool for hours. Really fun.
West Seattle?
There was some in West Seattle, Caddyshack, if you remember that place.
I don't.
Next to the Admiral Theater. It's gone now. I think it's gone. But then there was a place down in, you'll love this, down in downtown, 7th of Virginia, called Jersey's. We spent so many damn... It was a ugly bar, but they had like 25 pool tables, and we just played pool there for hours.
I don't remember really that place either. Now that's a fancy part of town.
That's where, you know, Fair Start, you know that organization, Fair Start?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's they're in that spot now. They're in that space.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, but, interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe I do remember that bar. Yeah, I do remember that bar now that mm-hmm. I didn't mention it. I didn't know what it was called, though.
We played a lot of pool.
Did you ever go to the pool place that was... like from the movie Color of Money, downtown, second floor.
Uh-huh.
I think you and I actually went there.
Like something 222.
It was, yeah. And it was like Second Avenue.
Uh-huh.
It was in this, it was a nondescript door.
Yep.
And you went upstairs.
Right.
And it was a brightly, you know, fluorescent lit room.
Yep.
And no frills.
No.
Just a bunch of hustlers playing pool.
Serious pool. We were there mucking about the way we do, and the guy who was running the place, he was like, you don't do that here.
Meaning so, we were being loud and we weren't playing.
We were playing our version of pool, which isn't serious, but that place is like a library.
Yeah, it was. I remember that. And it's like, why would we even go there? But we would.
We didn't know. And they had a snooker table, which is, we tried to play that.
Impossible.
That is really hard to do.
Yeah, snooker's impossible.
Yeah.
Smaller balls, smaller holes, bigger table.
Huge table.
And you have to do combos.
There's things you have to do to, I can't remember how to play it, but yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it's like all the most difficult elements of pool ratcheted up.
Right.
But anyway, well, that's interesting. So when I asked that question that patron Christine was asking, where was Bob going when he hit the student driver? I thought you were going to say, well, I was just going to the grocery store and that would be it.
Yeah. No. Well,
apparently it's
going to a deeper. 12-step meeting.
Yeah. Well,
I didn't make the meeting that day.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's complicated. Yeah. I mean, certainly, yeah, you should not be ashamed. That's horrible to do that to yourself or be shamed by other people. But it is interesting how in our world, particularly your world, my world of clinical work, that it raises eyebrows, what you just described. There's no way to reconcile it without it either being, and I don't think this way, but I think a lot of people would, that either you were faking a whole thing going to AA, being disingenuous, or you were misdirected or something, or you've been living a life of a, you know, semi-alcoholic afterwards since. There's no narrative or system of understanding where you could have that story and have the before and after and have it just be what it is, which in my view is just like, well, there was a period of time where you didn't want to drink and you thought maybe I have a problem. And so you went for it instead of just not drinking. You're just like, well, I'm going to go to AA and experience all that. Because, you know, AA involves a lot more than just not drinking. It mm-hmm. involves talking about your feelings mm-hmm. and bonding with other people, mm-hmm. helping other people, mm-hmm. talking about your thought processes and a lot of things. So, yeah. It'd be like, well, how is it different than saying, I went to a group therapy situation for a year, or I went to therapy for a year. And a big part of the therapy was me talking about not drinking. And then it eventually I was just like, you know, I think I can, you know what I mean? Cause AA is such a specific thing, right? It's entering this whole other world.
It is.
There can be, not always, but there can be such dogmatic points of view So, you know what I mean? So it's an interesting story that I don't think I've ever really heard in that progression, in that full mm-hmm. story. But yeah. I'm guessing there's a lot of people like that. And why not? What's the harm in having that kind of a story? There shouldn't be anything notable or shameful or a reason to not mention it. That, you know, you didn't do anything wrong. You're not some sort of pathological denial person. No. So and at the time you weren't deluding yourself. Like it all can be true. It's a both and for the whole thing. You know,
right. I met some lovely people there, and I have nothing but respect for AA and for the people that go to AA. Alcohol can be a real beast. They were very kind and welcoming, really lovely mm-hmm. folks there. I don't begrudge Martin for saying what he said. He was just telling me how he saw it in a very funny way, actually. Bob, what are you doing here? Anyways, yeah.
Let's take a break and we get back. More questions, what do you say?
Sure.
All right, Bob, upper tier patron Jackie, she says, Hi, Kirk and Bob. Thank you for the episode on Bob's attachment. I think I learned more in this time than the 3 years of therapy I've been in. Having complex trauma from childhood, I can empathize and identify with Bob about his Paper Boys segment. Can you tell me? Remind me the Paper Boys segment.
Paper Boys.
Do you remember?
Paper Boys.
Yeah. That didn't ring a bell either. Maybe a butler? Maybe that's what she's referring to? Paper, I don't know.
I used to have a paper route, so maybe that? I don't know.
Paper boy segment. Anyway, I appreciate him sharing how he worked through the whole thought process with Colleen. Was there a Colleen paper boys segment?
Paper boys.
Anyway, I paused to take notes for the future, but then when he spoke about not feeling lovable, this spoke to my soul as well. Hmm. The shame part is real. If Bob can become at peace with himself, there's hope for me. Thank you, Bob, for being willing to share.
Thank you.
Up at your patron, Avery from Canada, she says, hi, Kirk and Bob. Can you go through what therapy looks like when you're having a couples counselor help you and your partner to break up? My partner and I have both expressed fear that a therapist will suggest we break up because he wants kids and I do not.
Oh.
Maybe you explaining it would make that possibility less scary. So just chime in here. Okay, so what up at your patron, Avery, is saying is that, you know, we disagree, me and my partner disagree about whether or not to have kids, and we want to go to therapy for a variety of reasons, including this, but we're worried the therapist is going to get it in their head that we're doomed, that we need to break up. So I think Avery's saying, Bob and me, what is that threshold, or how would you broach it, or whatever. P.S. Thank you for everything that you do with the podcast, Kirk and Bob. I always appreciate your insight. P.S. My dad's name is also Kirk.
Oh.
End of email. Avery, I appreciate that detail about your dad, because I meet so few people with the name of Kirk. And every time I do, it's just a weird experience, you know? So, Bob, what is it like to, you know, have a couple that disagrees on this, and two, what would you do regarding helping people to break up?
When I used to do Gottman, I remember being at a Gottman therapy training, right? And I remember him saying that he thought that this situation was a deal breaker, that if a couple didn't, if one of them wanted kids and the other one didn't, they probably shouldn't be together. He said it, and so I just sort of took that in and like, okay, that must be the gospel then. And so I'll just, you know, have that attitude. But anymore, like, I don't know. I don't know what people should do. If anybody showed up in my office with this kind of particular, with this particular dilemma, I would not say you should break up, because I feel like that's none of my business. Like, how the fuck do I know if you should break up? So what I would say is, clearly this has, you know, this is a big deal for each of yous. And what happens when you talk about it? Can you talk about it? When you talk about it, do you guys fight? Do you withdraw from one another? Do you find yourself? Because that's the only thing I know how to do, is help people stay connected while they have a difference. But all couples have differences, so it's not like it's a big deal. I think there's probably a lot of meaning associated with it, but it isn't really like any other difference. Like, you're a Republican and I'm a Democrat. Mm-hmm. You know, okay, so we vote different. And
yeah, to me, it's a big deal.
Yeah,
and it needs to be focused on to some extent. And when I watch 90 Day Fiancé and other shows like this,
right,
I'll often say, you know, because they'll have these major conflicts once they're married or something.
Right.
And I'll sometimes say, maybe you should have talked about this before you decide to get married and actually have kids together or something like this. Anyway, so it's a big deal, but there's a lot of big deals in therapy. There's a lot of conflicts, and there's a lot of paths in life, and there's always sacrifice when you decide to commit to someone,
right?
And that some of those compromises or sacrifices might be that you can't live in the town with your family because each of your families live in different towns or something,
right?
You know, one of you has to sacrifice that,
right?
And those can be big deals.
Yeah,
they all need to be considered and fully appreciated before you take the leap,
right?
You know, into entwining one's lives, particularly having kids, but
sure.
But you know, there's sacrifice, meaning that can someone say, well, I will sacrifice for you by either having kids or not having kids? Now, of course, you don't want to be in a situation where the person who doesn't want to have kids really doesn't want to have kids, you know what I mean? So because they need to be participatory and enjoy the children. But some people are like, well, I'm kind of like, I'd rather not have kids, but if we did, you know, I'll get into it, and
yeah,
I'm not going to resent it or anything. And the opposite. Some people will be like, you know, I really want to have kids, but, you know, pros and cons. I don't want to lose my partner.
Right.
And I know enough about myself to know that I'm not just giving in because I'm a pleaser. I'm actually willing to... there's other ways of meeting that need. You know, I can be more involved with my nieces and nephews, or I could have other kinds of ways of whatever I'm trying to get out of having kids. So there's that. But so, Bob, when would you, if ever, give a vibe or even recommend that a couple break up?
As soon as they say we should break up.
Right. Yeah. Meaning that you would never otherwise.
I would never. And even if they said that, I would never say, yeah, you're right, you should.
Yeah.
I don't know if people should.
Yeah.
I think anybody that says they know is Hubert. It's full. They're playing God. It's full. They're full of shit. They don't actually know.
Yeah. And it's incredibly untherapeutic. And I've heard of therapists doing this. So, yeah. I mean, Gottman, who knows what he would have done? He's not a clinician, but who knows what he would recommend people do in a situation like that?
Isn't he a clinician?
He doesn't do clinical work.
Oh, yeah, he does.
Oh, he does?
Yeah.
Oh, I forgot. Or I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I knew Julie did, but I knew Gottman is a researcher.
I think mostly that's what he does nowadays is clinical work.
Oh, huh.
Yeah.
I think he does supervision too, right?
Does he? I don't know.
I don't know.
And it's been a while.
Anyway, point is that, yeah, could clinicians... suggest people break up. Yeah, and they have. And but I would imagine most couple of therapists know better than that. I think there are a much greater likelihood of a couple of therapists starting to have an idea that the client should break up and get divorced and might give a vibe of that. And I've done this before. I'll route things either an individual or a couple therapy. I'll have questions that kind of allude to an opinion that I have that they should break up. But whenever I do that, I try to recognize it. It's counter transference and I'm starting to take too much responsibility.
Right on.
Yeah. But it's normal to do that. You know, if you have a client that's talking about an abusive partner or something you're deeming to be abusive, it's natural to want to protect that person and want them to break up, right? Especially if the victim is saying a lot of things that seems to be in denial of the victimization they're going through. You know, it's normal, but it's not a helpful thing. Now, might you advocate? Might you raise questions? Might you do a lot of things to try to help that person have the self-awareness and self-esteem and the... giving themselves the permission to leave. Yeah. But that decision is still up to them and it's not up to us. Up to your patron Maria from Washington. She says, fun question for Kirk and Bob. This is kind of a question you and Umberto usually get into, but I enjoyed the tangent you and Bob went on a few weeks ago about storytelling. Bob mentioned When Harry Met Sally as a perfect example of a well-crafted story, and I have to agree. It is my all-time favorite rom-com and love story trope of enemies, rivals, to lovers. For example, Pride and Prejudice or Ben and Leslie in Parks and Rec. What is your favorite romantic comedy or love story trope? Bob, what is your favorite rom-com?
I don't know if it's my favorite, but the first one that comes to mind is Joe versus the Volcano.
Okay.
That's a good one.
It's been a while since I've seen that. Tom Hanks and...
Meg Ryan again.
Oh, Meg Ryan.
Yeah.
Okay.
I love the end. They're sitting on the steamer trunks in the middle of the ocean, and he's like, well, yeah, I know, but I'm dying. And she's like, what do you mean you're dying? And he's like, well, I got a brain cloud. He's like, what's a brain cloud? And he's like, blah, blah, blah. And my doctor, who's the doctor? She's like, my dad owns that doctor. That you're being snowed. And he's like, I'm not going to die? And she's like, yeah, you're not going to die. You're fine. Yeah, right. Okay, great. I'm alive. And then he's like, yeah, but we're still... in the middle of the ocean on these steamer trunks. And she looks at him and she says, it's always going to be something with you, ain't it, Joe? And he goes, yeah. I just love that line. It's like the perfect validation.
Does that resonate with you particularly?
I appreciate being seen. Oh. Yeah. Because she doesn't need to engage him about whether or not this is or isn't a problem. She just recognizes he's the kind of guy that would just see it that way and she accepts him. Uh-huh. I love that.
Right. There's not a rejection from her in that.
No. This moment. It's always going to be something with you, ain't it, Joe?
Yeah. Well, I actually took some time and actually tried to figure out my top rom-coms.
Right on.
And number one is Harold and Maude.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
from 1971. There are obviously problems with this story, given the fact that it's a minor and a grandmother, great-grandmother involved in a relationship. But if you watch the movie, it doesn't come across like the kid's being exploited. And the kid, I don't even know if we know he's a minor. He might be 18, but anyway. But Harold Maude, I mean, for 1971, for this movie, and I remember seeing it when I was a kid. It would come on TV sometimes, and I remember liking it even when I was a kid. Cat Stevens does the whole soundtrack, and
who doesn't love a Jaguar turned into a hearse?
I know. Yeah, it's a dark and humor, and it's very proto Wes Anderson as well. It's way before its time, Harold Maude. Number two, Annie Hall. Obviously, we got problems with Woody Allen and his personal life of abusing his stepdaughter and maybe others, his own, well, and then marrying one of his adopted daughters or adopted stepdaughter or something. So obviously this, but Annie Hall, I watch it every few years, and every time I watch it, I always expect that I'm going to not like it again because of one-on-one Woody Allen and his personal life, but also because I've seen it so many times. Right. I mean, I saw this movie in the 70s and 80s that it would be played on TV.
Yeah.
Every time I watch it, I'm like, my God, this movie is so good. It's so well written. It's funny. It's interesting. The character development, the rom-com elements, the bittersweetness at the end. Because you could argue it's not really a rom-com. It's kind of a tragedy in some ways, you know?
I never saw it.
Oh, you haven't?
No.
Yeah, it's not, it doesn't have a Hollywood ending.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't make Woody Allen look like a good person the entire time, you know? And it's just a perfect rom-com. It's so good. There's flashbacks to when he's a kid. It's pretty autobiographical.
Mm-hmm.
And I find Annie Hall just to be... And you just marvel, I marvel at, like, I find that movies outside of these movies, they overthink it or something, or there has to be some sort of gimmick, or they make it too long, or they don't know how to find the right vibe or something, you know, and it just makes me, it also kind of makes me angry and sad that there are so many movies being made and so few of them nail it, like Harold and Maude and Annie Hall and another movie, which is my third best rom-com, which is The Big Sick from 2017 with Kumail Nanjiani and Zoe Kazan. It's based on Kumail's real life.
His real life.
And his wife, who's played by Zoe Kazan.
Right.
Or Kazan. I don't know how to pronounce her name. I also mispronounce Paul Dano is how you pronounce Paul, you know.
It's Dano, not Dano?
It's Dano, yeah. Okay. I watched him on Hot Ones where they eat the hot wings, and he was introduced as Paul Dano, and he didn't say anything. So, but Zoe Kazan or Kazan and Paul Dano are a power couple.
Yeah.
I love both of them, both as writers and actors, or at least Zoe, she's a writer. Anyway, but Kumail in real life went through a situation where his real wife at the time was having a massive amount of medical problems and I think might die.
Yeah, coma.
Coma, that's right. And so...
And he didn't know her that well.
He didn't know her that well.
They were fairly fresh into their relationship when she got sick.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a whole part. It's been a while since I've seen the movie, but
I want to watch it again now. It's a great film.
Yeah, Big Sick. I was completely blown away at how heartfelt this was, and to know that it's a true story just elevates it beyond anything else. It's so good.
He has the best dry delivery.
Yeah,
he's so good.
Yeah, Kumail is. He's just hilarious. Honorable mentions are My Big Fat Greek Wedding, Defending Your Life. Albert Brooks.
Wow. Julie Haggerty. Oh, my God. Oh, no, wait. Defending Your Life. Is that Meryl Streep?
Meryl Streep.
Yeah, yeah.
Defending Your Life. Yeah. They're both in The Afterlife.
Well, that's right. I'm thinking of Lost in America. That's also Albert Brooks.
Right.
But okay, yeah. Defending Your Life.
Some Kind of Wonderful. Eric Stoltz.
Oh, yeah.
Barry Stewart Masterson.
Oh, so cute.
Amelie. Great
movie. Oh, Amelie. Yeah, oh, yeah. So fun.
What's Up, Doc? With Babs and Ryan O'Neal. Another problematic person, Ryan O'Neal.
Never
Do you remember
that?
That movie was on pretty frequent rotation on regular broadcast TV. A fair amount of movies that I know of is because they would just be like the Sunday night movie.
Right, right.
And another one that was on frequent rotation was Wild, 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 Wild World. The one where it's like they're trying to find the money.
Yeah.
And
wait, it's a Mad, 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 Mad World?
Or no, it's a Mad, Mad, Mad,
right,
Mad
right,
World.
Right, right, yeah, right. Yeah.
Palm Springs, 2020 movie. It's similar to...
I don't know that one.
It's similar to Groundhog's Day, where they live the same day over and over and over again. It's pretty good.
Who's in that?
It is What's-His-Face from SNL, and What's-Her-Face from a lot of things. Anyway,
Bill Hader?
No. Well, that's a good guess. Similar. Yeah. Andy Sandberg.
Sandberg.
Yeah.
God, listen to me.
Crazy Rich Asians. I didn't think it was amazing, but I thought it was pretty good and particularly enjoyable because a lot of Asians and Asian Americans. Can't Buy Me Love. I love so much from the 80s.
That's Robert Downey Jr., isn't it?
No, it's the guy from...
Patrick Dempsey. Grey's,
yeah, Patrick Dempsey.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Have you ever seen Grey's Anatomy?
I think I watched part of one episode once.
Never watched it. Wouldn't even be able to tell you what channel it was on or anything.
I think it's still on.
I think it's still on. It takes place in Seattle, does it not?
Yeah, supposedly.
Yeah. But just never... Yeah, I'm sure it's a fine show. Say Anything, of course. It's classic.
Oh, Say Anything, right.
Seattle movie. And The Princess Bride. So
Better Off Dead.
Better Off Dead. Would you call that a rom-com?
I don't know.
I guess you could. It's more of a comedy comedy.
More of a comedy comedy, say, yeah. Yeah.
But
wait, what was the last one you just said? Say Anything?
Princess Bride.
Princess Bride. Oh, yeah, Princess Bride, sure.
All right, so... Kim from Ye Olde Crossroads, Bellevue. I'm not sure why Kim said Ye Olde Crossroads, Bellevue, but that's just where, you know, nearby where I grew up.
Yeah.
Crossroads. My mom and I have a strained relationship, and she is a massive trigger to my anxiety. I know she means well in her own way. How do I make real progress in trusting someone who won't go to therapy with me to work on this and sees me only as the problem? Bob, what do you think?
Maybe you can't trust her to go to therapy or change her view of things. So can you...
So what Kim is saying is, how do I make my relationship better with my mom, even though she's not willing to look at herself, essentially?
I don't know. Maybe... I mean, I could imagine lots of things. Observing your own limits around what you are and aren't willing to put up with. And being mindful about that, not where they should be, but where they actually are. Because the definition of a limit, as I understand it, is that degree to which I can go no further without something changing. Something changing in me. Like, if I spend 3 days with you, I lose my shit, so I can do a day and a half. But why don't you come and spend a week? No, I can do a day and a half. That's it. And that's a perfectly legitimate thing. You know, observe your limits. And the other thing, you can accept her as she is. And I mean accept as it... Think carefully about that word. It doesn't mean approve of, agree with. It just means this is as she is. And actually, when you accept somebody is as they are, I think it can make it easier to observe your limits. Like, just say, well, yeah, this is as far as I can go without, you know, feeling like bad or whatever.
Yeah. This is a huge topic.
Yeah, huge.
That I'm going to try to lightning round this, which is to say that on, and I fielded a lot of questions like this on the podcast. I've worked with a lot of clients on this issue, and there's a lot of different things to consider. One is it really the best option to have any kind of relationship with this person? I mean, I'm not saying completely cut off, but maybe that, or maybe it's just like extremely limited expectations and contact where, you know, you see them, but you just don't really, you don't get vulnerable. You don't have hopes. You know that the BS is going to happen and triggering is going to happen. And you just have no expectations that that will ever change. And you don't depend on this person, or you just completely cut yourself off from that person. I mean, that's a total, so you want to ask yourself, is that the, given the fact that I have limited years left on this planet, is that the best approach? So the other question you want to ask is, how can I, as Bob was saying earlier, accept? Is that possible? It might not be possible, but can I accept? And for me personally, myself, I have people in my life where I have had that, where I have said, well, I don't want to cut them out because it's not necessary, but and it might be really hard to do so. But I also have reached a point where I recognize who they are, and I don't have any ability or leverage to be able to change anything because I'm not close to them. But they're going to be that way, and I just have to realize that. And at the same time, I can be open and jovial and just have extremely low expectations. And then when something happens that reminds me of why I have a limited expectation with this person, I'm like, oh, there it is. And I don't take it personally. It's just, you know, it's their issue. But once I cross that threshold, I'm no longer struggling, you know, I'm no longer just like upset as much or trying to change them as much or question, you know, I've sort of landed on this sort of plateau of where I'm at. Another question to ask is, how am I contributing? Because, you know, I might be contributing. Another question to ask is, how can I change my relationship with this person? Or do I have undue pessimism about them potentially changing? Because, you know, I've talked with a lot of people in therapy about, they'll say like, well, my parents, they'll never change. And for one reason or another, in the long-term, you know, action of therapy, we might get to a point where the client might actually try to change their parents. And I would say 60% of the time, it's bumpy. It's a bumpy road, but the parents do change. You know, they do at least exhibit that they understand and that they care. And universally, the clients or the people that I'm talking to will say, I cannot believe that my dad even admitted that maybe he has a problem with this. I mean, he's not being perfect, but I did not expect him to have any acknowledgement or any softness or any self-awareness or any compassion about or any validation. But, you know, he kind of did. I mean, he's got a ways to go, but I can't believe, you know, because you can get real locked in on a perspective with our parents, particularly if there's a lot of pain and a lot of dashed hopes that result in you giving up or adopting a point of view of just like, look, Kirk, you just have to accept that that's how they are. They're never going to change. They're a horrible person. You know, you just kind of, it's a way of coping that you just have to do to yourself because you'll beat your head up against the wall. But maybe if you have the capacity and the right approach, beating your head against the wall one or two more times in the right way might actually get through the wall, so to speak, you know. So there's just a lot of different options, and to explore them, I think, is the key. And yeah, so I don't know what the answer is, but that's the approach, Kim from Crossroads. All right, that does it for that episode of Psychology in Seattle. Thanks for joining us out there. Please take care of yourself, because
you deserve it.